We are replacing the current tax code with oranges.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 201. I want to begin with art today. As a part of his America First budget, President Donald Trump has proposed numerous cuts in his budget. He's proposed a $13 billion cut, that's 16.1%, to Health and Human Services, HHS. He's proposed an $11 billion cut, that's 29%, to our State Department. A note about this cut in the State Department. The State Department is our diplomacy department. More on this cut later on. He cut the department, he wants to cut the Department of Education by $9 billion, or 14%. This cut itself, I think, is self-explanatory. After all, Trump was not shy about his love for the poorly educated during the campaign. He's also proposed cutting the Environmental Protection Agency by 31%, effectively eliminating 50 programs that's currently being run by that department, and 3,200 jobs. By the way, these cuts, all these cuts that he wants, they don't reduce the federal spending. These cuts won't reduce the deficit. That's because Mr. Trump is also asking for an additional $2.8 billion increase for the Department of Homeland Security and an increase of $52 billion for the Department of Defense, a department that is so bloated with fiscal resources right now that already has a larger budget than the next dozen countries combined. Buried within these draconian cuts is the elimination for what is known as the National Endowment for the Arts. As pointed out by Andrea K. Scott over at The New Yorker, quote, picture militants destroying statues with sledgehammers. You may have seen this video on the news recently. Destroying statues with sledgehammers in Iraq's Mosul Museum. Of the extermination of a culture as a vile form of propaganda, unquote. ISIS absolutely revels in destroying priceless and historical artifacts. There has been no shortage of them carrying out this kind of vandalism in recent days. Now, Donald Trump promised to defeat ISIS within 30 days of his inauguration with a secret plan. You may remember the secret plan, 30 days. He said it on Fox News to Greta Van Susteren. Perhaps the reason that he has not done this is because they too clearly share both his love of war and destruction and a disdain for the arts. The Trump White House has said explicitly that the cuts are necessary in order to make way for the dramatic increase in the military budget. So, art. I understand there's tons of cuts, but I want to be personal here. Art is my life, and I want to share my story with you about what art means to me. As a young man, I've not been quiet or coy on this program about the abject poverty, starvation, homelessness, and abuse that I suffered as a disadvantaged kid growing up in the ghettos and economic prisons of America. In our house, we regularly stole cable TV when I was a kid. This led to me being exposed to music television. I wasn't huge into TV shows, but I liked watching musical performances. MTV, VH1. I discovered rock, punk, metal, and hip-hop. And I would endlessly watch videos all day. I didn't have a lot of friends or social life or any of that. I figured out, once I got my hands on some stereo equipment, you know, started messing with stereo equipment, I figured out a way to run the audio for our television through our archaic stereo, and I was able to start recording music off of the television, things that came on TV. I guess, suppose you can call it the early days of music piracy. I was recording them on cassettes. And then I discovered BMG and Columbia House. More music theft on my part. I stole a ton of music as a kid. But here, understand this. We went into Iraq. We had this idea that we had to liberate them. We had to bring them democracy. At the end of a barrel, we're going to bring them democracy. Here's the thing. If you have something good, you don't have to force it on people. people will find a way to steal it. And I suppose this is a microcosm of that. So to get these little cards, I would go to drugstores and, you know, take those little postage paid cards and I would send them in. And 4 weeks later, I'd have CDs. And then I would just toss the bills away whenever they came in, pretend I wasn't there. And if they ever managed to get our number and call the house, mom would say, well, you sold CDs to a kid. Screw you. I know that CDs today are a little antiquated. However, to this day, I still don't feel like I own a record unless I own a physical copy of it. As a kid, I was shy, I was quiet. I was a frequent target for bullies at school, a frequent target for abuse at home at the hands of my mother. However, when I became a teenager, and I was taller than her, she decided to outsource her abuse to her boyfriend. So then I began getting abused at the hands of her boyfriends, whichever guy she was dating at the time. Church wasn't any better either. Being a quiet, shy, gentle, soft-spoken, I became the target for bullying even at church. The words fag, faggot, homo, they were hurled at me more times than I can count within those four walls. And this just made me turn inward even more. Occasionally, I would make a friend, but it was rare. I instead spent most of my time inside watching and listening to music. I would lay there on the floor with headphones on. I would sit in front of the television and just watch performance after performance. I would get to know, when I got my hands on a CD, when I got my hands on a cassette, I would get to know every album that I owned backward and forward. Every lyric, every lick, every beat. Eventually, this led to me studying what I was hearing. It's not official music studying, but it's still studying. Cadence, speed, syllable count, song structures. I began to decipher what made a song. And more importantly, what made a good song. And by the way, what makes a good song isn't just repetition. Wanting to write my own songs, I decided to take a guitar class in high school. I lived in California at the time. I enjoyed it, and I was on my way to becoming a good guitar player. In California, you can take a performing art or a language. You're not required to take a language to graduate from high school, so I took guitar. Clearly. Now I don't have a foreign language. I wish I did, though. But after a few months in the class, my guitar, which was borrowed from one of my mom's boyfriends, by the way, my guitar got stolen. In the school, we had a closet where we kept guitars so that we wouldn't have to lug them around all day. You know, we'd come in the morning, put it in the guitar, closet, and then we'd go about our day. And then when we came into guitar class, third or fourth period, whatever it was, the guitar would just be there. And so we'd take it out of the closet, and then we'd put it back in, and then we'd come collect it at the end of the day. That way we're not lugging a guitar around school all day because, schools are kind of narrow places. Classrooms are kind of narrow places. There's not always a place for you to put your guitar. I forgot to bring it home one day, and then I was out the next day because I was sick. I stayed home ill. And when I returned to guitar class the next day, the guitar was gone. The guitar belonging to my mom's boyfriend. Of course, it made him angry, and we weren't able to get me another guitar, so I unfortunately had to drop out of the class. Fast forward, I met my dad for the first time when I turned 15. I left California for Spokane, Washington, to live with him for my final year of high school. And when I got there, he bought me right away. I suppose, not seeing me for 15, 16 years, he bought me a guitar. And I began playing again. I was an okay player. You know, not a great player, but that didn't stop me from trying to join a band. When I tried out for one of the local bands, though, they let me know. They reminded me that my guitar skills were not that great. But what I lacked in talent or knowledge for music, I had in heart. They asked me to try out on vocals, and it is there that I remain to this day. We wrote songs, we played live. Initially, I would perform with my back to the audience. All new territory for me, obviously, facing the band. However, before you know it, I was facing the crowd, gaining confidence, shedding my inhibitions. At that point, I started becoming more open, more social. When the music that I was making started gaining some approval, I started feeling better. I started making friends. I'd get noticed in public. People would learn my lyrics and sing them back at me. And it began a pretty profound change for me. something that I certainly wish would have happened years ago, but was pretty damn happy that it was happening at that point. So as I got older, I started hitting karaoke bars, and it was the same kind of response, you know, lots of energy, you know, this vocal style that I had, people would notice. I still wasn't necessarily keen on speaking in public. However, give me a stage and a mic and a mix, as the old song goes, and I'd tear up the stage. This led to me being out more, and I eventually ended up meeting my wife. We would go to the karaoke bars, and she was taken in by this personality, this out personality that, looking back, even, you know, 5, 6, 7 years from there, I would have been not out. I would have been staring at the wall. I would have been quiet. I would have been to myself. I wouldn't have been out among people. But music, art was driving me to do this. And of course, because I had been involved in music for so long, by the time I met her, I was already bubbling, fun-loving, and had an attitude that drew her to me. And those nights, those definitely played a role in the fact that we're still together today. Then I became even more ambitious. Disappointed by what I was hearing on local radio with respect to music, I decided to do something about it. So I went to broadcasting school. Within a year, I was working at a radio station doing on-air news, which led to more opportunity. I also briefly worked at a television station in the control room and running cameras. And because it's me, and I was just getting more amped up, more confidence, more energy, and wanted to be around more people, I decided to go ahead and get another job. And oh, by the way, by this time, I was already in to another band, but I've got itchy feet. So I decided to take a shuttle driving job with a hotel that had a contract with a local casino, which led to me meeting tons of famous and talented people, including the group Kool & the Gang, which I was and still am a gigantic fan of. Around the same time, I was also in a whole different band, as I mentioned, as a vocalist. We played tons of shows, recorded an album. I left Spokane in 2011 due to economic circumstances. Obviously, I've mentioned this before, the Great Recession ran us over. Within a year of moving to Portland, I was in talks with a new friend to start a podcast, where I remain to this day. As of last week, we just celebrated episode number 200. And now, as I talk to you today, due to my vast musical and technical knowledge, I was asked to do my sister-in-law's wedding back in 2013, which led to me starting a lucrative business that is still in business and growing to this day. And all of this happened because of art. My art was and still is music. Yours might be painting or knitting, glass blowing, glass, whatever it is. But art makes the world. And it didn't just open doors for me. It kicked those doors open, and I learned how to run through those doors. If not for art, I don't know who I'd be or where I'd be. My beautiful bride, Sarah, certainly wouldn't have married me. I'd likely still be quiet, shy, and alone, or I would have ended up with someone drab and boring, like I was. Perish the thought, I know, right? No show, no music, no album, no friendships, no DJ business, nothing. I can't be the only one with this kind of story. And by the way, art did not turn me in to this kind of person. I believe that I was always this person deep down, the guy that I am now, the guy that people see in public, the guy that people see at weddings, you know, the guy that you hear on this show. I believe that I've always been this guy. But it was only through the expression of art that I was allowed, that I was able, you know, as a deeply abused youth, to let this out. Art promotes color, inclusion, expression, blending, critical thinking. And this must be why art is not just openly mocked and ridiculed by conservatives, but being defunded and eventually eliminated. Art makes the world a better place. It encourages interaction, action, sharing of ideas. The Defense Department promotes war, terror, slavery, fear, killing. And of course, It wraps it up in a neat little package, and it labels that package security and protection. Case in point, 14 years after the beginning of the Iraq War, and 15 years after the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, no one is safer, and no one is protected. I'm not promoting the idea that we defund the Pentagon and begin shoveling it all into art, although the world will probably be a beautiful, beautiful place. I believe we can walk and chew gum at the same time. However, less money spent on killing and more money spent on creating, I can promise you that that would have a way better outcome. I know that the current presidential administration hates the planet and the human race. So my words fall not on their deaf ears. But for anyone within the sound of my voice, if you can take one thing away from this monologue, it is this. Art saves. Sevestra. War kills and art saves. And we're better than this. We can do better than this.
If you plan to like save the world through global warming and you wouldn't really want to work for a green energy field, well, the place to go is actually to work for Chevron and Exxon. They actually are funding all of the green energy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. Clearly, the oil companies are funding all of the green energy stuff, just in case you haven't noticed. What's happening right now is a clear assault on our senses. There is so much corruption in America right now that it seems that we're absolutely bathing in it. And I think what's happening is there's a normalization happening of corruption. It's trying to make us feel like this is just the way things are, that this is the new normal. Everybody needs to get used to this America because this is what it's going to be from here forward. In Russia last weekend, there was a crackdown on protesters. There were tens of thousands of people that turned out on the street despite the fact that Vladimir Putin told them that if they dare turn out in the street, that they will be breaking the law because what they have as a protest is unsanctioned and it's unapproved by the government. And true to his word, as soon as those Russian citizens hit the street, and by the way, they don't like him. They are done with him. They would like to be rid of him. But why do they keep electing him? They're not electing him. He's stealing the elections. And of course, his parliamentary house, what would be, say, his House of Representatives and his Senate, they're completely full of people that have to vote with whatever the heck he wants them to vote for, and they have to vote in lockstep. And if they don't, if so much as one person steps outside and votes against Putin, those people are ran out of the country, and sometimes they're even eventually killed. Putin does not like democracy. Trump does not like democracy. The Republican Party does not like democracy in any of its forms. If you look at their attack on unions, you'll begin to understand a little bit better exactly how they feel about any group of people coming together and deciding what they want for the group. In majority numbers. Here in America, in a lot of the red states, since Trump's election, a lot of red states have been passing laws, not specifically saying that you can't protest, you can't be out in the streets. But what it says is if you're protesting and you're walking down the street, you know, say you're walking through the middle of the street with a group of people and somebody decides to mow you down and kill you, that's going to become what we're going to refer to as stand your ground, but with a vehicle. And in Washington State, where I live, one of our legislators, our right-wing legislators, has decided that he wants to reclassify it as terrorism. Follow me here. Because he says if you're out in the streets, then you're blocking potential commerce, right? If you're blocking sidewalks, you're blocking potential commerce. And that is economic terrorism. And you should be arrested and tried and locked up based on the fact that you're a terrorist. So Putin's Russia is coming to Trump's America, or it would seem. And they're not being quiet about this. There's an article over at Huffington Post where they talk about more of the anti-worker things that Trump is doing. And what's amazing to me is all of these working people voted for him. Right? I mentioned this at the end of last week's show about, I said, you're being taken by, you got taken by a con man, and not even a good con man. Just one of these late night 2, 3 a.m. infomercial con men. That's who you got taken in by. It's embarrassing. So the headline at Huffington Post, Trump repeals regulation protecting workers from wage theft. Quoting here, companies that commit wage theft and put their workers in harm's way just received a favor from the Trump administration. Donald Trump signed a bill this past Monday repealing a regulation that encouraged federal contractors to follow labor laws. Under the Obama-era rule, companies with an egregious record of violating wage and safety laws would lose their government contracts if they didn't come into compliance. The idea behind the rule was to make sure that unscrupulous employers didn't receive taxpayer dollars, but Republicans in Congress thought the rule was too punitive and unfair to business. They used an arcane tool known as the Congressional Review Act, CRA, in an effort to kill the regulation, which was called the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Rule. By approving the legislation sent to him by the Senate, Trump has ensured not only that the regulation will die, but also that no similar regulation can be put forth by the Labor Department again. Trump signed the legislation at the White House ceremony in front of the press. According to Heidi Sherholz, a labor expert at the Economic Policy Institute, she said in a statement, by blocking this rule, the president and congressional Republicans will ensure that taxpayers will continue to support contractors with a history of wage theft and safety violations. The Labor Department said that the rule would apply to 14,000 contractors each year, but only a small share of these is expected to have reportable violations. They're just not big fans of worker rights. And it's not just this worker regulation. It's really any worker regulation. Fox News went ape crazy a little bit ago after President Obama decided that he was going to pass a family leave rule.
This is anti-childless. I mean, so you have a baby and you get time off. What about people like me who don't have children? I would actually sue. I have a ferret. I like to spend some time at home with my ferret, roll around.
I see.
But I am okay with this. Yeah. One stipulation, when you return from your parental leave, you are not allowed by contract to show us pictures of your baby.
Understand, ladies and gentlemen, the voice that you're hearing in that clip is the voice of the Family Values Republicans. See, when you have a baby, and I think anybody with children knows this, the best place for not just mom to be, but also for dad to be, is at home in those early formative years of that child's life. And they're saying, no, get your ass to work, start producing for your boss, and toss that brat into daycare, and then start shelling out gut loads of money for daycare. Family values. They also talk a lot about the Constitution.
They love the Constitution. Oh, they just want to kiss its face. They love the Constitution so much
that they talk about it all the time. I think what they like is the idea of following a document that was written by slave owners. Let's not mince words here. It was written by slave owners, and it's got some great things in it, but the way it's being interpreted by conservatives isn't that great. And when they project what they think the Constitution says, what their interpretation of what's in the Constitution, it seems to most people, most fair people, that what they believe is in the Constitution is not really in the Constitution. And so here's what's happening now. There are, I believe, 32 red states that have Republican governorships, Republican houses, and that's despite the fact not getting a majority of votes, you know, or winning elections with very low turnouts. So what you're seeing is these states electing Republicans without a true majority. States that have voter ID laws that keep African Americans and elderly people and college students away from the polls so that they only get, you know, white, conservative, you know, middle-aged Christians, whatever, out to the polls because they know how those people are going to vote because those people are so susceptible to their message. But here's the scary thing. Wisconsin just became the 29th state to call for what's known as a constitutional convention. There's been a great number of articles written, some over at Alternate, some other places. But this one I'm pulling here is written by Jacob Sugarman. And it says, the Wisconsin GOP is calling for a constitutional convention and only needs five more states to make it happen. So what would a constitutional convention be if they get 34 states? It's 34. If they get 34 states to agree to this, then they can get together and convene a constitutional convention, which is where, and I'm not kidding about this, they rewrite the entire Constitution. So Republicans control 33 state legislatures right now, okay? And they only need 34. Only 29 states have agreed to a constitutional convention. So if you look at, you know, your Koch brothers and some of these other wealthy donors, they are chomping at the bit right now. Oh my God, do they want this to happen? Because if they can rewrite the Constitution, they don't, and but they love the old one. But man, if they had one that allowed them to do the things that they say are in the original Constitution, quoting here from the article, imagine if the U.S. Constitution barred the EPA and the Department of Education from existing. Imagine if their constitution said that all unions are dead and there are no more federal workplace safety standards or even child labor laws allowed anymore. And by the way, no more minimum wage. Imagine a constitution that makes it illegal for the federal government to protect you from big polluters, big banks, big food, and even pharma. All are free to rip you off and poison you as much as they want. And your only remedy is in the state courts and legislatures, because the Constitution prevents Congress from doing anything about it. The federal government can't even enforce voting or civil rights. So your only recourse would be in the court system, which, by the way, is also largely controlled by conservatives. So when Scalia died last year and President Obama put forth a new nominee, like the Constitution says that he needs to do, the Republicans tried to use what they refer to as the Biden rule, which, by the way, is not a rule. It refers to something Biden said back in 1986 in the final year of the first term of Reagan's presidency. He said that Reagan couldn't put someone on the court because he was in the final. It's not a rule. It's something that Biden said, and nobody agreed with it then. And nobody agrees with it now. But this is what they used in order to stop Merrick Garland from getting on the court. So fast forward to now. So, well, actually, let's get into May of last year. I think it was May. Then candidate Trump said that if he was elected president, and he released a list of, I think, a dozen Supreme Court justices. And he said, these are the kind of judges that I would put on the Supreme Court. Absent from that list was Neil Gorsuch. So, of course, all of these cranky billionaires went to Trump and said, you know who should be on your list? And you don't pull anybody off your list. That would look suspicious. Is you should have Neil Gorsuch on that list. As a matter of fact, if you become president, you should make Neil Gorsuch the next nominee. And so what he did later that year was he released another list. And I think it was another half a dozen or so Supreme Court justices, or maybe a whole another dozen. I can't remember, but I remember the story coming out. And it was another. He goes, you know what? These people would also be good on the court. He just had some names thrown out there. But then, of course, on that list was Neil Gorsuch. What the people who are closely associated with Trump wanted was they wanted Gorsuch added to the list. Or for the name Gorsuch to be released by itself, you know, to get conservatives and multinational corporations salivating. That's what they wanted. But instead, they made it like he was just releasing another list of people that he would put on the court, when really, this was just to put Gorsuch's name out there. Now, when Merrick Garland was picked, Merrick Garland never even got a hearing. The Republicans said, we're not even going to give him a hearing, hands down. But of course, the Democrats, not playing the same game, decided to go ahead and give Gorsuch a hearing. There's a lot of talk about filibustering him right now, and I think it's really, really important that they do filibuster him. Because here's what we have on the court. We've got an even split right now. And Merrick Garland he's a conservative, but he's not super hard right conservative, right? He wouldn't shift the court to full fascism for the remainder of his life. And by the way, Neil Gorsuch belonged to a group in high school called Fascism Forever. Fascism is really what Neil Gorsuch traffics in. That's what he wants. And he has constantly been on the side of large multinational corporations and never, ever, ever, ever on the side of workers. So Neil Gorsuch went up for his hearing. And think about the courts going the Gorsuch direction. And think about a constitutional convention, right, where we turn America so far to the right that it just devolves into indigen in ruin. So when Gorsuch went up recently for one of his hearings, Sheldon Whitehouse decided to open up the hearing. And he opened it up with a fairly lengthy statement. And it was a number of shows ago when I played a long clip of Michelle Obama. I try not to do that all that often. I've only gotten an hour a week with you fine folks, and my time with you is very precious. But there are, and I make a lot of clips for the show, but there are just some things that I can't pare down to a bumper sticker or a short slogan. So I'll probably pause from time to time. But what I want to play for you is Sheldon Whitehouse's opening remarks talking about what a Gorsuch court might look like.
Now, Senator Whitehouse.
Judge Gorsuch, welcome. As we discussed when we met, the question that faces me is, what happens when the Republicans get five appointees on the Supreme Court? I can't help but notice the long array of 5-4 decisions, with all the Republican appointees lining up to change the law to the benefit of distinct interests, Republicans at the polls and big business pretty much everywhere. Let's look at the 5-4 decisions. First, helping Republicans at the polls. All the Republican appointees' 5-4 decisions on election law favor Republicans at the polls. 6-0. Helping Republicans gerrymander, paving the way for the Republican Red Map plan that won the House against the American majority in 2012. Jubilee, 5-4, all the Republican appointees. Helping Republican legislatures keep Democrat-leaning minorities away from the polls with targeted voter suppression laws. Shelby County, 5-4, all the Republicans. Bartlett v. Strickland, 5-4, all the Republicans. Helping corporate money flood elections and boost Republican candidates. McCutcheon, 5-4, all the Republicans, counting the concurrence. Bullock, 5-4, all the Republicans. And the infamous Citizens United decision, 5-4, all the Republicans. In each area, the court made new law, 5-4, and each decision predictably helped Republicans win elections. At 6-0, it's a partisan rout. Then look at cases that pit corporations against human beings. All the 5-4 Republican appointee decisions line up to help corporations against humans. Citizens United and the political money decisions should again count here. All three of them, 5-4, all the Republicans. Then come decisions that protect corporations who've harmed their employees. In pay discrimination, Ledbetter, 5-4, all the Republicans. In age discrimination, Gross, 5-4, all the Republicans. In harassment cases, Vance, 5-4, all the Republicans. In anti-retaliation cases, Nassar. Yep, you guessed it, 5-4, all Republicans. Then there are the decisions that protect corporations from class action lawsuits. Walmart v. Dukes, 5-4, and Comcast, 5-4, both all Republicans. Then there are decisions that help corporations steer customers away from juries and into corporate-friendly mandatory arbitration. Concepcion, an Italian Colors restaurant, both 5-4, both all Republicans.
I want to talk about that arbitration one real quick. If you've noticed, most contracts that you sign have an arbitration clause in it. And what that does is that eliminates the odds of you being able to sue the company, right? It says that you are agreeing to some sort of mediator that they pick if there is a dispute. It's just more things to strip you of your rights.
The Iqbal decision, 5-4, all Republicans help bar the courthouse door for all types of plaintiffs. All of this helps keep corporations away from juries, the one element of government hardest for corporations to control. Indeed, as you know, tampering with a jury is a crime. The court also helps big business against unions. Harris v. Quinn, 5-4, all Republicans. Last year, Friedrichs was teed up as a 5-4 body blow against unions when Justice Scalia died. With a new 5-4 court, they'll be back. Throw in Hobby Lobby. Corporations have religious rights that supersede health care for their employees. 5-4, all Republicans. Add Heller and McDonald, reanimating for gun manufacturers a legal theory a former Chief Justice once called a fraud. 5-4, all Republicans. Help insulate investment bankers from fraud claims? Why not? Janus Capital Group, 5-4, all Republicans. Chamber of Commerce v. EPA gave corporate polluters an unprecedented victory. Again, 5-4, all Republicans. That's an easy 16-0 record for corporations against humans. To me, every time seems like a lot. There's no coincidence here. Big business has law groups out trolling for test cases to go get those cases before the friendly court. The Republican politico-industrial complex piles in with amicus briefs and floods to tell the Republican appointees on the court what it wants. Republican justices are even starting to give hints so big business lawyers can rush to get certain cases up pronto to the court. It's kind of a machine. Special interests set up and fund front groups. The front groups appear as amici before the court. The amicus briefs of the front groups tell the court what the special interests want. The court follows the amicus briefs. The decision benefits the special interests, and the special interests pour more money to the front groups. On it goes, like turning a crank. The biggest corporate lobby of them all is winning better than 2-1 at the court. This 5-4 rampage is not driven by principle. Over and over, judicial principles, even so-called conservative ones, are overrun on the court's road to the happy result. Stare decisis. That's a big laugh. These were law-changing decisions, many upending a century or more of law and precedent. Textualism. The Second Amendment uses the military term, arms, and talks about militias, but never mind that when the gun lobby wants something. Originalism. There's a particularly good one. Find me a founding father who planned a big role for business corporations in American elections, or one who would have countenanced the steady strangulation of the civil jury without so much as a mention of the Seventh Amendment. The Citizens United majority even fiddled with court procedure to get to the decision it wanted to deliver, dodging its way around a record that would have belied their findings of fact, setting aside that their findings of fact were factually preposterous, as events have shown, and that appellate courts are not even supposed to make findings of fact. It's not just us who notice. Top writers and scholars describe the Roberts Court as essentially a delivery service. Jeffrey Toobin wrote in 2009, even more than Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts has served the interests and reflected the values of the contemporary Republican Party. Linda Greenhouse in 2014, I'm finding it impossible to avoid the conclusion that the Republican-appointed majority is committed to harnessing the Supreme Court to an ideological agenda. Norm Ornstein has described what he called the new reality of today's Supreme Court It is polarized along partisan lines in a way that parallels other political institutions and the rest of society in a fashion we have never seen.
I want to make a mention about the Roberts Court really quickly. So the Citizens United decision, and I've mentioned this on the show before, but the Citizens United decision was about a group called Citizens United that wanted to run what was, they called it a movie, but what it was a hit piece on Hillary, and they wanted to run it in October of that year, if I'm not mistaken. And you can't run, you know, something that is clearly propaganda and call it a movie or a documentary or anything, you know, so on TV so close to an election. So they sued in order to be able to run that movie. And what the Robert courts said was, here's what you should do with your case. Go away, reframe your argument to include all political spending on elections, and then come back to us and argue that with us. And the Citizens United group did that. Citizens United went away, came back and argued for large spending for corporations, unlimited money for corporations to spend on elections, and that's exactly what the Roberts Court gave them. The Roberts Court is already largely, as it is, you know, and it's split 4-4 right now, is already a delivery system for what the rich multinational corporations want, and only what they want.
Studies of the court's decisions show it's the most corporate-friendly court in modern history, with Justices Roberts and Alito vying to be the most corporate-friendly justice. And the American public knows something's gone wrong at the court. A 2014 poll revealed that a majority of Americans think a person won't get a fair shake in this court against a corporation. Now, where do you fit in? When Hobby Lobby was in the Tenth Circuit, you held for a corporation having religious rights over its employees' health care. Your record on corporate versus human litigants comes in by one count at 21-2. Four corporations. Tellingly, big special interests and their front groups are spending millions of dollars in a dark money campaign to push your confirmation. We have a predicament. In ordinary circumstances, you should enjoy the benefit of the doubt based on your qualifications. But several things have gone wrong that shift the benefit of the doubt. One, Justice Roberts sat in that very seat, told us he'd just call balls and strikes, and then led his five-person Republican majority on that activist 5-4 political shopping spree. Once burned, twice shy. Confirmation etiquette has been unhinged from the truth. Two, Republican senators denied any semblance of due legislative process to our last nominee, one, I would say, even more qualified than you, and that's saying something. Why go through the unprecedented political trouble to deny so qualified a judge even a hearing if you don't expect something more amenable to come down the pike? Those political expectations also color the benefit of the doubt. Finally, the special interests who've done so well in that 5-4 extravaganza of decisions are now spending millions and millions of dollars campaigning to push your nomination. They obviously think you will be worth their money. These special interests also supported the Republican majority keeping this seat open. I'm afraid that all costs whoever now sits in that seat the benefit of the doubt to answer this question. Will you saddle up with the other Republican appointees and launch the court 5-4 again on another massive special interest and Republican election spree? I hope whatever we may disagree about on this committee, we can at least agree that we can't have a court where litigants in these 5-4 decisions can predict how they'll do based on who they are. Because here's what it looks like now. If they're big Republican election interests, they'll win every time. If they're corporations against a human being, they will win every time. And, Your Honor, every time seems like a lot.
The Hobby Lobby decision was especially egregious, saying that a corporation has a religion. Hobby Lobby was already offering, and what they sued for was to not have to offer contraceptive coverage to the women that work for their company. they were already offering contraceptive coverage to the women at their company. And then, when the ACA, Obamacare, became law, they decided that they didn't want to do that anymore because they're a religion. They went to court, and they got exactly what they wanted. It's important to recognize these things as they're coming up, as they're happening. And what's happening with Gorsuch right now is millions of dollars are being spent in states making him look like the second coming of Jesus. Like he's just going to be so great for workers, so great for people, so great. But he's got one client, and it's not you, the working people. It's the super wealthy. And if he captures that chair as a relatively young man, and the Republicans get their constitutional convention, the country will change forever. And it won't take long to devolve into complete indigence and ruin, to a caste society, a society where we're all serfs, and they get everything. A small group of people at the top with all the money and all the power, and then those of us at the bottom with damn near nothing and fighting for scraps. It is more important than ever that we get involved in this process. It is more important than ever that you call your legislature. It is more important than ever that we continue to resist. It doesn't have to be this way. This doesn't have to be the future that we are facing. This is history being made right now, and we're very much a part of it. Get out there, please. Get involved. And if you live in a red state and you're a Democrat, understand this. There's a pretty good chance you can run for office and win. In most red states, Republicans are running completely unopposed. Republican judges are running completely unopposed. And a lot of people don't realize that. Red states aren't necessarily red because they're so conservative. Red states are usually red because of the perception of deep conservatism. And the belief, the long-held or common belief, that Democrats simply can't win. But in this era, in the era of resist, in the era of fighting against Trump, in the era of fighting against corporatism, your chances are better than ever of running for and getting into office. Don't doubt yourself. Get out there and make it happen. Gorsuch's country is not our country. Trump's country is not our country.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people because they have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
This from a guy who believes that the National Enquirer is actually news. The problem isn't that the news is fake. The problem is that the news is real. But the news isn't always the propaganda that he wants you to hear. And the assault on the media is becoming more stark than ever.
What is it about the television coverage of you in these past weeks and months that has so aroused your anger?
Don't get the impression that you aroused my anger.
You see, I have that impression.
You see, you... One can only be angry with those he respects.
When Richard Nixon said that to a reporter back during the 60s, that was considered pretty egregious for a president. And if you listen to the way this president in particular talks to the media, it just shows you how far we've come. Now, Richard Nixon had to resign for crimes that he was clearly committing. But he saw the real problem was not the crimes that he was committing, but the fact that those crimes were being reported. Time magazine recently ran a headline On the front of their magazine, they ran an article back, you know, a headline back during the 80s, and it said in three letters, three words on the front of the cover, "Is God dead?" And they sort of revamped that for the modern age, and now it says, "Is truth dead?" referring to the Trump era. And so Scott Pelley was asked about this, and they go, do you really think, Mr. Pelley, that he hates the media?
I don't think he's mad at the media.
You don't?
I think he's mad at not being boss anymore. Any president comes in, and he has to answer to the public, he has to answer to the Congress, he has to answer to the courts, and the only thing Donald Trump has done in his life is run a private family company. Yeah. I asked him in that same interview, I said, who tells you no?
Very, very true.
Stumped him.
Yeah.
He could not come up with a name of anybody who tells him no. But now, as president, one of the most constrained jobs in the world, all day long people are saying, yes, sir, Mr. President, but you can't do that.
And I think it's true. The problem is that he doesn't have just a bunch of yes men around him anymore. He's got people telling them what they really think of him, and what they really think of him isn't much. But you have to understand, this guy has been having his ego stroked by the media for years. He was given a reality TV show. They have a huge love affair with him over on Fox News. They give him all the positive press that he wants. And Glenn Beck, finally, you know, one of these guys that really helped usher in the Trump era, said, yeah, you know, I don't know, maybe we're a little bit responsible for this, I don't know.
When you have a guy who is angry and then has an enemies list and starts just to take people down over and over and over again, if you disagree with him, he destroys you. If that's the mood of the country, then we're in more trouble than I thought.
Well, but here's the thing. Is there a little bit of reap what you sow in some of this for the GOP, that engendering an oppositional mode towards government, in ratcheting up negativity as a mainline discourse, you wound up somewhat birthing Donald Trump, and now some of those people who are angry about what was going on and telling people to be angry, now they've got somebody who's harnessing the power of exactly that, and you're disappointed.
It's years and years of right-wing propaganda that have brought us to where we're at right now, with the state of our media, with the guy in the presidency, with the way that the public feels, the way what the public wants doesn't reflect what the people in power are delivering. CNN is playing a pretty interesting role now that Trump is president, after covering him so much, after running so many of his speeches unedited and without any sort of commenting on it. Now they're speaking out against him.
I don't want to spend too much time discussing this issue because we have a lot of news to cover today, but let's not make any mistake about what's happening here. A White House that has had some difficulty telling the truth and that has seemed to have trouble getting up to speed on the basic competent functioning of government, and a president who seems particularly averse to any criticism and has called the press the enemies of the American people, they are taking the next step in attempting to avoid checks and balances and accountability. It's not acceptable. In fact, it's petulant and indicative of a lack of basic understanding of how an adult White House functions. In fact, Sean Spicer in December seemed to completely understand this. He said the White House would not ban any media organization as the Trump campaign had. He said, quote, "We have a respect for the press when it comes to the government. That is something you can't ban an entity from, conservative, liberal, or otherwise. I think that's what makes a democracy versus a dictatorship." The Trump White House now, led by Sean Spicer's White House operation in the communication division, is now targeting multiple media organizations, and it seems to think it can punish reporters for sharing with you facts that they don't like.
Now they're coming out against Donald Trump, and they're being pretty stark about it. But what should happen is these kind of things need to be prevented in the first place. These kind of things need to be stopped before they grow too big. Because once they grow too big, well, now the monster that you're fighting against is conceivably, or in effect, larger than even you.
So don't misunderstand what's going on with that rhetoric and with today's action banning various media outlets, including CNN and the New York Times. This White House does not seem to respect the idea of accountability. This White House does not seem to value an independent press. There is a word for that line of thinking. The word is un-American.
Obviously, it hasn't always been this way, and not all presidents feel this way about the press. The press was not necessarily a friend to Kennedy either, but even Kennedy was willing to admit that the importance of the press, it's only conservatives, right? It's only the current group of conservatives that we have now. I don't even like to call them conservatives. I suppose we'd call them regressives, you know, or banana Republicans. But it is only them that thinks it's a good idea for us to not have a press and to only have a propaganda arm that only pushes right-wing propaganda.
You once said that you were reading more and enjoying it less. Are you still as avid a newspaper reader, magazine? I remember those of us who traveled with you on the campaign, a magazine wasn't safe around you.
Oh, it is. No. I think it's invaluable, even though it may cause you some, it's never pleasant to be reading things frequently that are not agreeable news, but I would say that it's an invaluable arm of the presidency as a check, really, on what's going on in administration. And more things come to my attention that cause me either concern or give me information. So I would think that Mr. Khrushchev, or operating a totalitarian system, which has many advantages as far as being able to move in secret and all the rest, there's a terrific disadvantage not having the abrasive quality of the press applied to you daily to an administration. When you have, even though we never like it, and even though we don't, even though we wish they didn't write it, and even though we disapprove, there isn't any doubt that we couldn't do the job at all in a free society without a very, very active press.
We cannot let truth die, and we simply cannot let the Fourth Estate be killed, and we cannot let these barons get away with this stuff. On this program, we are going to continue to fight for truth. Sure, we're progressive here, but we're not just going to push, you know, our own ideas and our own propaganda, because I think it's important to get good information out there and not this hair on fire information, not this tabloid stuff. I'm going to close with a quote today. I heard a quote by Timothy Snyder, who just released a book about tyranny. And the quote is, "Believe in the truth. Without truth, we don't have trust. Without trust, we don't have the rule of law. And without the rule of law, we don't have democracy." So people who are post-fact, people who are against the truth, are taking the direct line to killing democracy. What did Kellyanne Conway call it? She called it alternative facts. That's post-truth. Inside the White House, they are right now taking the direct line to trying to kill democracy. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store, at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for the Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail is just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. We are the Fire You Can't Put Out. My name is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.